God made man and the dog to live in the same frame of reference, and therefore we're not surprised when we have the same lung system. Now, you just move it over in epistemology, you can feel the force of the whole thing. I'm not surprised in the subject-object relationship. Can't imagine where that went to in my notes, but it doesn't matter. So we find that Polanyi destroyed positivism and was left with cynicism. The Christian destroys positivism and is left with worship. It's a very, very different thing. And worship is not a leap in the dark. There's no leap in the dark here. I would just bring this right in to the thing which Udo Mittelman said so beautifully in this morning's worship service at this place. There's no Kierkegaardianism here. It doesn't exist. Whether in Genesis 22 or whether it's in the larger aspect of the thing that God has made or about it. Now we must consider, however, this thing I raised before, and that is the accuracy of knowledge. We must face this. All these things relate to language, which introduces the subject of semantics and linguistic analysis. It does. It's quite right. Modern man is right. All this is linked to the question of language. Now, as we do this, let us think of language at this point. And there are three possible views of language at this point. Three possible views of language. The first is this, and that is because we bring our own backgrounds to language, and we all do, you know. Because we bring our own backgrounds to language, we cannot communicate properly at all with each other. Our own backgrounds so mark our words and our phrases that our words and our phrases do not touch. That's the first concept. The very opposite concept is that as soon as we use a term, everybody has an exhaustively absolute and common meaning of the term, or to the term, because they use the same word. These are the two opposites, the two extremes. In the question of language, and also, by extension, incidentally, into epistemology. These are the two opposite views. I do want to say in a bracket here, I think I must, that the evangelical's problem is the latter one. We have often been very naive about language, and we have assumed the last one. We have assumed as though all language, and especially all evangelical words, are like cinder blocks. And as soon as anybody uses a word, he means exactly with it what we mean. That's absolutely naive. And it's why, exactly because we haven't taken time to find out if he means what we mean by the word we use, because we haven't taken time to find out, you have so many people who make a profession of faith and they never say, there they still stand because they haven't understood one word you've spoken, simply because you've assumed that words are just like cinder blocks. This is a very serious thing in evangelicalism if we're going to talk the gospel to people. So therefore, let's look. Here's these two extremes. But isn't there another possibility as well as these two extremes? No, there is one. There's another possibility, and it's what we find by experience. And what we find also, incidentally, in a very careful study of language. In reality, how does language operate in the world? Does it operate in either of these two extremes? And the answer is no. Surely we find that while we do indeed bring our own backgrounds to language, which gives a word or a phrase a special cast out of our own background, yet also, if we take enough reasonable care in our dealing with each other, we find a sufficient overlapping on the basis of the external world and human experience to ensure a sufficient meaning in order to communicate, even though we fall short of an exhaustive communication. Now, that's the way all we experience in language, constantly. What you have, you see, the one man says there's a total overlapping, and that's really very naive, as I'll show you in a moment. The other man says the complete opposite, and that is we bring our own background to words to such an extent that there's no overlapping, and so the words pass like this. But neither of these are our experience if we take some care in the use of language. The illustration I use over and over again, year after year, because I like it so much, and that is my wife and myself and the symbol in the word and the linguistic symbol, T-E-A. T-E-A. T-E-A, after all, just a symbol in the linguistic symbol. That's all. Now then, let us think of this word, this symbol, T-E-A. What does it mean to Edith? Well, it means certainly to this Edith, and that is, among other things, and that is T-E-A, though I'm sure that wasn't a symbol at the moment, because she spoke Chinese before she spoke English. But nevertheless, the symbol, the parallel symbol, represents to her something of a very definite nature. When she was a very, very little girl, her mother was afraid that the rather rich Chinese food would upset her stomach, that she had it every day of the week, so she's only allowed to have it every so often. And so she was told that she wasn't to go out and eat the Chinese food in the compound in China except at certain times. But she was a very naughty little girl indeed, really naughty. And being a very naughty little girl, she didn't do what she was told. She liked Chinese food, I'm glad. And she went out every day if she could get a chance to sneak out. Maybe that's a nasty word. But anyway, she went out as often as she could into the compound, and pretty soon she was confronted with the meaning of the symbol, the linguistic symbol in Chinese, equal to the English symbol, T-E-A. What did it represent? It meant that you had a big mouthful of rice. Like this. And you had a bowl in your hand that you held with two hands. And if you were really a smart little girl, that symbol meant that you could drink the tea around one side of your mouth without disturbing the rice in the other corner. By the way, it's deep, though. Now, I'm making you laugh, but think what I'm saying. Don't get lost in the laughter. That's what TEA meant to her. Now, what's TEA mean to me in the beginning of my existence? And I'm just in plain old TEA at this place. But TEA meant to me, somewhere in Germantown in Philadelphia, I had a mother that made tea in an aluminum thing. An aluminum thing. And she made this tea in the aluminum thing. In the beginning of, to me, TEA is that tea made in that funny aluminum thing, which the English would all laugh at. And then you come across here, and you have Edith with T-E-A, the other. Does that mean, surely it's not a cinder block, is it, any longer? But does it mean when I say in the morning, dear, will you bring me a cup of tea, that there's no linguistic possibility of getting a cup of tea? And I want to tell you, better think this through if you're in university day and you have any relationship to modern semantics and modern linguistics, and if you're getting messed up on the area of epistemology. This is where you must think this thing through. You do not have to choose either the concept, the simplistic concept that too many evangelicals seem to have about our own kind of technical cliches and words, of a cinder block. On the other hand, the fact that you can't talk at all. You simply don't have to do these. I would throw in here another illustration that's very precious to me, and that is one that happened to me in St. Andrews University a few years ago when I was lecturing there. And I was lecturing at St. Andrews, and a Christian said to me, we have a boy nobody can talk to, apparently. We don't know what goes wrong. We don't understand it, but nothing ever comes out of it. It's all confusing to us. Would you talk to him? So I had a half hour to talk to this boy between a lot of appointments, and I came in, and he had really a lovely spread in his jig for a lovely tea. And tea now means something more than just something in a cup. So we came in, and I sat there, and he didn't serve me, you know. For a moment, and I started to talk to him about Christian things. So I only had a half hour. I felt a bit rushed, and I didn't say anything too deep into it, but I began to talk. I forget how I opened it, and he said, sir, I don't think we're communicating. So I talked again for another 2 minutes, and he said, sir, I don't think we're communicating. I tried again the third time. He said, sir, I don't think I'm communicating, and I knew jolly well who I was talking to. I was talking to a linguistic analysis man. So I thought, what in the half hour can I say? If this keeps on, it's going to sound like a phonograph, you know. We're not going anyplace. And I was disturbed for him. And I looked at this beautiful tea, and in Scotland, they really know how to lay out a tea. Scones, the lot, you know. It's lovely. And I said to him in a very rude way, I said, pass me the tea. He looked at me, Dr. Schaefer being very, very rude, and he quick poured some tea, and he handed it to me. And I said to him, sir, I think we're communicating. And from that time on, we had the nicest conversation you could ever imagine. So you must understand these things are not theoretical. You're fighting for your lives and for other people's lives. I'm not making jokes, am I? Some of you people really down in the guts of all this understand that this is life and death. You better get it figured out, and we better get it figured out. Exactly what we mean in contrast to what we do not mean. It's not just word games we're making. It isn't just word games. So we don't have to choose between these two extremes, in language nor epistemology. We can know truly without knowing exhaustively as long as the thing is there and I am in correlation with it. I can know. We're all creatures of God and we live in His world. When we use words, we do not exhaust them. Even words like house and dog are not exhausted between one person and another. But though they have personal overtones, nevertheless, we can communicate in an accurate, if not an exhaustive way. Now then, as Christians, the simple fact is that we would insist that the same principles are involved in the areas of knowing as we have seen in the area, in the shorter focus of semantics. It is the same thing in regard to accurate knowledge concerning the subject-object relationship. We are not surprised that we do not know the object exhaustively. Only God knows anything exhaustively. But also, we are not surprised that we can know it truly, for the same reasonable God has made both the subject and the object, and thus we're not surprised that there is a correlation between them, and there is no other answer. It doesn't exist. Remember what I said about Plato understanding that the problem of universals in particular is not only in the area of morals, but all the way deep into epistemology. This is what we're talking about. Now, what is the conclusion to having the Christian position and therefore having no problem of epistemology? This is an entirely new section. It's the last section. Three results. Three major results of applying the Christian view of epistemology is set out in the previous chapter. And I trust now you remember my summary that I made at the beginning. I gave you three dilemmas of modern man in the area of epistemology. And now we're going to see what the Christian answer says about this. The first problem is me looking out. That's a very simple way to say it, but I really think it's the best way I know how to say it. Things deeper than any other way. Me looking out. The first of these I'm speaking of then I'm calling me looking out. Now this is a very simple way to put it. It nevertheless represents the basic problem of all epistemology. How can I have any certain knowledge of knowledge in general? And secondly, how can I distinguish between knowledge of what is there objectively in contrast to a hallucination or illusion? This is the basic problem of epistemology. Now, obviously, we must concede that there are borderline cases. Brain injury, schizophrenia, and other forms of mental illness may blur the distinction between objective reality and fantasy. And, of course, the taking of a modern drug produces a similar condition. You must understand that modern drug taking produces an imposed schizophrenia. That's the point of the whole thing. So whether it is a psychological illness or an artificially imposed mental schizophrenia caused by drugs, the Christian sees it as this is a symptom of the fall. So we have a reason to know within our system why at times there's something wrong here. Just as in the area of morals, you can think of my long, long discussion on the fall, the space-time fall in the area of morals in the second lecture. Things are not completely the way God made them to be in the first place. There are alienations between God and man, between man and himself, and between man and man, or man and nature, all the results of the fall. So, therefore, it's not surprising that there are these borderline cases in the realm of true knowledge and of fantasy. But notice, this is not a complete situation. The Christian is an entirely different situation from the modern man. From, let us say, the thinking behind Antonioni film Blow-Up. The Christian has a certain right, the Christian has a certainty, right from the start, that there is an external world which is there, which modern man never can come to. Under the apex of the modern man system, he is never sure that there is anything there. Under the apex of his system, there is no way to be sure there is any external world, even to get your teeth in. Antonioni's Blow-Up. Nobody. You're not sure. The Christian, on the other hand, has a certainty right from the beginning of his position, right from the beginning of the Christian teaching, that there is an external world that is there, created by God as an objective reality. Created by God as an objective reality. And please remember all my arguments against positivism, again, at this particular place. Without a reason for the certainty of an external world. There is no subject for scientific subject, no basis for experiment or deduction. But the Christian, being sure of the reality of the external world, has a basis for true knowledge. He has a basis for true knowledge. This was the basis that launched modern science in the first place. What launched modern science in the first place is that they were sure there was something there. Modern man, I don't believe for a moment, could start science, even back into this stuff, let alone accuracy of knowledge. The Christian is not sucked by the borderline cases into Antinomian problems. He is not. He isn't sucked into it all the way down deep by the borderline cases. But notice, this isn't the end of the matter. But not only that, but the Christian can live in the world as God made it. The Christian can live in the world as God made it. Speaking of verification, falsification, it's all brought in at this particular place. It is not surprising, if a reasonable God created the universe and put me in it, that he should also give a correlation of the categories of my mind. It's the first time I've used this phrase, the next step. It is not surprising that he should give a correlation of the categories of my mind to fit what is there simply because I have been made to live in it. If this God made this universe, it is not surprising that the categories of the mind should fit the categories of what is there. There's no surprise. I just put in parenthesis, think of Levi-Strauss. Think of Chomsky at this particular place. It all enters into the discussion. Otherwise, there would be no correlation between the way my mind works and the way the universe has been made. If there was no correlation between the categories of my mind and the correlation of the universe that was there, there would be no way to know, be no way between the way my mind works and the way the universe was there. No man who begins with chance has an answer at this place. Nobody who begins by chance has an answer at this place. Nobody. Why should the correlation of my mind, kicked up by chance out of an impersonal universe, fit the correlators, or fit the categories or what is it? Makes no sense. It makes no sense. I would add Murray Eden's statements about 8 billion years at this particular point as well. Here's my note on the lung system. This is where I used it before. But put it in here for the moment. The lung system of the dog, the lung system of myself, a place on not on the moon, but a place here on Venus or Mars, but a place on the Earth. There is a correlation of the lung system, the correlation of the category of what? Way down God made it this way, of the subject-object relationship. That's the way God made it. The way God made it. Knowledge, if a reasonable God made the world, and he made me, we are not to be surprised in the area of this knowledge. If he made the categories of the mind to fit the categories of the external world. Both are the creation of an infinite personal God. This, of course, is very different from positivism, which is nothing in its system, anywhere in its system from its beginning to its end, to explain why is anything there. Positivism has no answer as to why anything is there. The system is defective at the very apex of what it needs to stand upon, or the base, as you want to think of it. And that is, you simply start out neutrally, and the facts meet you. But how do you know the data? And the system of positivism doesn't have one answer as to why you can be sure of the data. The Christian says, of course, if you begin the other way, the thing which all the early scientists believe, that began early science, that this was who made it. If you believe this, you're not surprised that the data is data. The very opposite of the dilemma of positivism. But secondly, let us notice this is not the end of the matter. There's something more in the biblical position in this matter of categories. When I read the Bible, it teaches me certain didactic thinking in words, in verbalizations, in propositions. But notice, it also teaches me in a different way. The first way may be called the didactic teaching. The Bible says, this is so, bing, bing, bing. This is what I say, speaks God. But notice, the Bible not only gives didactic facts. When the infinite personal God himself works in history, he works in a way that gives us complete confidence in what he has said about it. Very remarkable.
You think the Bible's simplistic. Really, you haven't read it. In other words, he says, this is the way the world is. And then when he works into this world, he never contradicts it. He works into the world the way he has said it is. Take it apart for a week. The more you think of it, I think the more you see how profound this is. These things I call the covenants of creation. God says the world is like this. But when he works into the world, he doesn't contradict what he says about the world, because he always treats the world fairly by working into the world exactly the way he says the world is. He doesn't ask us to act into it one way, and then he acts into it in a way that completely denies what he says it is. When the infinite personal God works in history and works in the cosmos, we find that he works in it exactly as he told us it is. The universal, working into the particulars, defines and confirms what he says the particulars are on the basis of the way he deals with them. And I want to tell you, this is overwhelming. You think of it for 10 years, it gets more wonderful all the time. He doesn't tell us one thing and then that the world's one thing and then he does another. He certainly does not. In the area of time, in the area of space, in the area of all the things, of the covenants of creation, he works into this world just the way he tells us it is. And this is a very profound concept indeed. In the area of miracles, surely there are miracles. But read the Bible. The Bible doesn't say everything's miracle. For instance, at the time of the rolling back of the Red Sea, what does God use? He uses the east wind. He uses the east wind to blow the Red Sea back. When Jesus is cooking a fish after the resurrection, what's he doing? A cooked fish. There's a fire. There's a fire to cook the fish upon. Profound. The resurrected Christ had a fire. Who made it? I don't know. The angels made it. But I know one thing. There was a fire to cook the fish upon. Christ did not deny what he tells us the world is. Here and there are miracles in the Bible. But the marvel of the miracles, that the miracles come at certain places. And in between, in the Bible, for the most part, God acts into the world in a way that confirms both my observation of it and also what God says about it in the didactic portion of the Bible. If everything was miracle, there'd be no miracle. Now then, the Bible gives us, in other words, two eyes to look through. I'm using a figure of speech here. I don't mean the two windows up here. The Bible gives us two eyes to look through. There is the didactic eye, but there is also the eye of seeing God working into history in the cosmos. And the two agree quite perfectly, totally perfectly. This is paralleled, for example, by that tremendous thing in the Westminster Confession of Faith that says when God tells us about his own attributes, when God tells us about his own attributes, they are true to him as well as to us. One of the most profound statements that men have ever written. They're true to him as they are true to us. He doesn't tell us one thing and then it's not true. He does not suddenly become the other at any point. The Westminster Confession of Faith is extremely, extremely deep and profound at this particular place. When he tells us about his attributes, they're true not only to us but to him. It is not that we have exhaustive knowledge of God, but we do have true knowledge because God told us about himself in his propositional word. And this carries further. It carries on when God works down into the universe. He works conforming to the way he has made it and the way in his verbalized propositional statement he has told us it is. We have tremendous, tremendous certainty at this particular place. So the universal and the particulars fit together not only as a theory, but God, the personal infinite God, who is the final universal of all things, thinking of it in this way. You could have objections to the term in a way, but I'm dealing with ideas at the moment. But God actually deals with the universe truly this way. And when on this basis, what? We begin to move out over the face of the universe and move into that universe the way every man has to live as though it were, as I have said. What do we find? What God says the universe is, and the way he works into the universe, and then we begin to work out from the Bible as God has spoken, we find that's what the universe is like, and we have no surprise that it fits. I'll tell you, the Christian is a free man. The Christian is a free man. On this base, continuing the thoughts, I'm continuing the thoughts of me looking out. Point result number one. On this base, continuing the thoughts of me looking out, what we find is that science is not a game. Modern science is becoming a game. Tremendous titanic game on two levels. Two levels. The early scientists had a reason for it not to be a game. They believed there was an objective universe there, and there's a reason to think they could find it out by reason. And there was no game to the science. It was truth. Marvelous truth to these men. Remember the quote from Francis Bacon that I've used in several of my books. Francis Bacon, the modern scientist. The early scientists, yes, what I call modern science, wasn't like that. But modern science has changed. It's often a game. Why it's a game? Because they're no longer sure there's any objective reality there, and they're no longer sure there's any correlation between the data that's fed to them and anything there. It becomes a game on two levels. I learned the one very sharply one time at one of our Ashburnham conferences. We had two or three, I forget which two, I guess. Very much, and then this is the third conference Lobbery has ever had. Two in Ashburnham, one here. And I was speaking something along this line, and afterwards a young scientist stood up from, I forget if it was Oxford or Cambridge, and he said, "Sir, you've missed something." And that simply is, most modern scientists are just the most bourgeois people you've ever met. I work with them, and I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Most modern scientists today, they're just playing a game. It's gamesmanship. They get involved in the specimen, and they get involved in all the little details so that they never, 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 never have to ask the big question." And he's absolutely right. And as soon as he said, I thought, this man really understands. He really understands. And I've questioned dozens of men since. And it's like this over and over again. It's even deeper than this. I talk to many of these modern scientists, and because of their epistemological weakness, the simple fact is that they are not even sure that the specimen is there. They're shut up with the dial. This is game. Games, games, games. All this proud science, it has turned into gamesmanship. It is no more really that noble thing that often is named under the name science in man's thinking as though it were made some great thing and some great objective certainty. No more, nothing greater very often to men today than the youngster who has too much money and he spends his whole lifetime skiing downhill every ski season, going everywhere to find one more ski run in order to knock 1/10 of 1 second from the right. No more than this. Why? Because the epistemology is gone, the basis. The other thing is even more scary. It's the thing I mentioned in the manipulation section again on the church at the end of the 20th century. The other thing that is far more scary is more and more scientists are using the thing which they present to the world purely as a means of sociological manipulation. Why are they doing it? Because they're no longer certain of the truth of the data that comes to them. That's why. Science is dying. Science is dying. Will science stop? Not if you're talking about technology. And not if you're talking about this is a thing that's let loose and will keep moving. Not if you're talking about sociological manipulation. But I want to tell you, I believe science, standing in that great proud place of where science believed it could stand at the day of the peak of positivism, I believe the day is past. I don't say every man by any means. But it's where we're moving. So we find, therefore, that because the epistemology has gone, science is going. Science is going. We're facing more and more science league being used only in the area of sociological manipulation. Why? Because the modern scientist has no longer any certainty of objective truth nor the existence of objectivity. Therefore, some scientists feel open to manipulate the findings to fit anything they want to fit. There are political views, there are sociological views. And it rests here. It rests here upon their loss of this sense of objectivity and epistemology. And I want to tell you, this is far more frightening, in case you don't know it, than the hippie who has lost his sense of objectivity. You may be frightened when you find one of these kids with a completely shot sense of objectivity. You may be frightened when they're coming back into your home after their trips, or even without drugs, and they no longer sure of the difference between reality and fantasy. But be 10,000 times afraid of the scientists in that place. 10,000 more times afraid. Becomes terrified. Terrified.
with this law.
Don't think of the things I'm saying then are only just nothing, just games we play. It isn't. It's desperately an important factor. But for the Christian, he is not here. He is not in this place happily. But for the Christian, he expects to touch the real. He expects to find out about it. He expects to be able to distinguish the real from the non-real. Why? Well, he expects it because God made it so. And this is just the way the early scientists did. They expected it. Copernicus expected to be able to fix his telescope and see the star. Isn't that beautiful? Why? Francis Bacon moved out and expected to be able to move across the scientific field. Galileo, Newton. They expected to be able to find the universe and work with it. The early men in medicine expected to be able to deal with the tumor and understand something about it. Beautiful and wonderful. But don't forget, it didn't grow on trees. It was rooted indeed in a Christian epistemology. When the Christian, when we come and we expect to be able to touch the world just as the early scientists did, are we filled? Are we filled with dismay when we move out? Not at all. When we move out across as the early scientists did with the view that the Bible gives us, and we move into the external world, we reach out without cynicism in the area of knowing. And what do we find? Verily, the external world is there, just as God said it's going to be. Why? Because God made it to be there. Now, that's point one. Result number two. Others looking at me. Others looking at me. And this is an overwhelming problem today if you're working with young people or if you are young people. Just an overwhelming problem. The problem of others looking at me. Now let us consider a second result of applying the Christian view of epistemology. This time in the area of others looking at me. What I am in the inward reality of my thought world, in contrast to the outward appearance of what I seem to be from the viewpoint of others. Is that all? It's important, isn't it, for those of you who wrestle with these things. But first, let me emphasize that the Christian does not have to choose between knowing the external and internal world totally or not knowing them all. I must not expect to know them perfectly because I am finite. But I may expect that it will all fit. The strength of the Christian and the acid test of it is that everything fits under the apex of the system of the existence of the infinite personal triune God. And let me say, with absolute finality, I do not believe there's any other system that fits, in which everything fits. I don't believe for a moment. I use the illustration at times. You must understand, opposite systems give you opposite answers and then have other pieces left out. So if you turn toward pantheism, it gives you an answer of unity, but it gives you an answer of diversity. If you try to give an answer of total randomness and chaos, you have an answer to the difference, perhaps, or the diversity, but no answer to the unity. And I use the illustration many, many times, and that is that maybe I used it here already, but you have the man, a tall, tall man, let's say he comes to Waymo, and we have a big garbage can there. We have these garbage cans about this high. And let's say we took this big, tall man, 6'4", and we decided to put him in the garbage can. We can make three theoretical possibilities. We could either put him in feet first, head first, or side first, if we could get him doubled up. But one thing would be sure, whichever way we stuck him in, something would be sticking out. And that's exactly the way the philosophies of the world are. It is not that they give no answers, but they do not give answers under their own apex, which include everything. Christianity, I would insist, is not this way. God, listening to the fact that he is there and he is not silent, he has spoken, there's nothing sticks out. It fits properly under the apex of the Christian system, the infinite personal triune God who is there. And that's why I want to say I am a Christian. It's how I start. It's where I made my move from agnosticism into Christianity when this began to dawn upon me. We as Christians can, without losing intellectual integrity, we as Christians can see that everything fits under the place of the Christian apex of the existence of the infinite personal God who is there. Never the word God. Never a contentless concept of God. But the God who is there has spoken and told us what is lust. That's the God that is the apex. This is true when I'm looking at the world, but it is also true looking inward. in this desperately important area for our generation, the problem of what I am truly in the thought world in contrast to what I appear to be outwardly. How can I truly know anybody else? The biblical revelation, according to God's teaching, binds not only the outward man, but it binds the inward man as well. That's spirituality. Spirituality is the understanding that the law of God and the norms of God bind not only the outward man, they bind the inward man as well. Think of the Ten Commandments. What's the last Ten Commandments? Thou shalt not covet. It's an internal thing. God's norms do not stop at the outward man. It binds the inward man. Without this, all fall, the rest falls to the ground if you don't have the understanding of what it means not to covet. God's Ten Commandments bind not only the outward man, they bind the inward man. God's giving of knowledge in history and in the cosmos binds not only the outward man, but it gives something to the inward man, and there is the unity. Both in the area of morals and in knowledge, it isn't the outward versus the inward, but as I become the more and more spiritual man, bringing my life by God's grace in the power of the finished work of Christ under God's norm, there comes an increasing unity between the outward man and the inward man. An increasing unity will ever be perfect, no, not until Jesus comes, but a really substantial difference. So the Bible gives a propositional revelation of God and norms for both the inward and the outward man, both in the area of morals and in knowledge. The inward man, according to the Bible, is not autonomous any more than is the outward man. Every human problem of bias, stress, and escape from reason arises because man tries to make something autonomous from God. And as soon as he tries to make something autonomous from God, everything goes wrong. And nature, to use my phrase in that book, nature begins to eat up grace in one form or another. Here we have the same thing. Nothing is autonomous from God between the inward and the outward man either. And not only in the area of morals, but in the area of the inward areas of knowledge. Meaning, values, think of Wittgenstein's word, silence. Knowledge, meaning, values, and the inward areas of morals, we are bound by God as much as in the outward world. And the Christian, as he grows spiritually, should be the man who consistently, more and more by God's grace, brings his thought world as well as his outward world under the norms of the Bible, both in morals and in knowledge. And as this is so, there comes unity. It will not be total perfect, but there should be a growing thing in this. But notice, even when we deal the Christian with an unsaved man who cares nothing for the norms of God, what about this? Even so, we're in a different position than the world. And that is, when we look at the non-Christian to know him, we have a starting place non-Christians never can have. We know who he is. And he does not know who he is. But we know who he is when we meet this non-saved man. We know he is made in the image of God. And it doesn't matter one bit what he says he is. He is still what we know he is. He is still made in the image of God. And in the side, then, therefore, we know something not only about his outside, we know something about his inside. We know there is a mannishness there, no matter how he is revolted against God. We know we're somewhere inside of him because he is, may have marred the image of God, but he is still made in the image of God. We know somewhere inside of him there is a reality as well as an aspiration of love and of wanting love, of moral motion, and all the rest, simply because he is made in the image of God. Let me tell you, that's marvelous. Marvelous to meet men who know they're rebelled against God, but nevertheless, these things are true about these men. Search somewhere, you'll feel a word of love. Search somewhere, you'll find some spark of love. Moral emotions that may be so corrupted that they stink to high heaven, but still moral emotions. A sense of beauty, a sense of significance. Couched, if you will, in the Eastern terms or the Western terms, the same significance isn't there. It doesn't matter. Find the individual. Dig deep. And you'll find he still has aspiration and significance. You know who he is. And he does not know. I was faced with this one day, and the most beautiful, one of the most beautiful things that ever occurred to me was out in Santa Barbara. I was lecturing in Westmont there, and they asked if I would speak, and I was lecturing away in Santa, in there, in the university or in the college. And I suddenly looked down and I saw a boy that knew jolly well didn't come from there. I could tell by looking at him. And those long hair, bare feet, you know, there he sat. A beautiful boy. And I thought, I wish I could meet him. Really beautiful, sensitive face. I thought, I'd like to meet that boy. And afterwards he came driving up, and you know, afterwards he sent someone up, that's right, and asked if he could have an appointment with me. So he never heard anything like this. It was one of my early type of lectures leading up towards, I forget which of the books. And so we agreed, and the next afternoon we met, and I was sitting in a little room there on the campus, and people coming every so often. And he suddenly came in. And I looked at him, and there he was indeed. All his sensitivity, you couldn't find a more sensitive face in all the world. And I stood up and I said, "My, I'm glad you've come. I've been waiting for your coming." And he got a look of absolute mystification on his face. And he said, "Why did you greet me like that? Nobody's greeted me like that for years and years." And I said, "Because I know who you are. I know you're made in the image of God. We had a tremendous time together." I knew who that boy was. I knew. He didn't know. But you must understand, the book of James makes very plain that the image of God is not completely gone with the fall. It's spoiled. It doesn't take us to heaven. It can breed the most awful, awful, awful thing of Sodom and Gomorrah, such as our own day. But search down there. Search down there. We know who this man is. We know there is some correlation between what man was made to be and what is there, no matter how horrible that man is in his morality, and no matter how far away from God in his walk. It does not matter. It does not matter. What I'm saying is, therefore, even with an unsaved man, even with a man who isn't a Christian, we have a way to start. We have a way to start because we know who he is. And that's the dilemma, and that's the hell of the modern person. He doesn't know who he is, so he has no way to get started from the outside in. That's it. As a Christian, we should be in a position where we are bringing the inward man under the lordship of Christ in the norms of Scripture by God's grace. And so we find that this, as a Christians, we should be able to be those who have more and more and more and deep and deep relationship with each other, not stopping at that horrible thing. Some of you young people know what I'm talking about. You walk this way. You ask some of these young people the hell of that walk. I want to tell you, it's a deep hole. It's a deep hole. To never be able to go past this. But as a Christian, suddenly we're flying here. We're free. The reason we have a problem in knowing each other is the discrepancy between what a man seems to be and what he is inside. How do you get through? But to the extent that people do accept the biblical teaching for the inward man as well as the outward man, inasmuch then as they realize that the inward man as well as the outward man is going to be under the judgment of God, increasingly there is a bringing together of the inward and the outward man. So increasingly, as this is consciously seen to be true, that the inward man is seen not to be autonomous, either in the area of values or of propositional knowing, or in the area of morals, it is possible to be more and more moved from the outward man to the inward man because there's increasingly an alignment, because both are bound by the same universal and it's beautiful beyond words what Christians have, if you only knew what we're throwing away. But for those who are walking in the swamps of this generation, there is only truth. There is not only no, there is no truth and there's no beauty. But suddenly, as this is understood, that both the inward man and the outward man are under the norm of God's revelation, and that God is going to judge the inward man as well as the outward man, this comes more and more. As long as the inward man indeed realizes that he's not autonomous from the speaking of God, there is a bringing together then of the particulars of both the inward man and the outward man under the same universal. If this occurs, there's a unity. And with this unity, we increasingly can get inside. We increasingly can get inside. You are older who still have these things, perhaps only as a memory out of Christianity. You still assume it. The young persons are quite consistent. They go on, they say, "I can never get started." But oh, don't you see, the real thing is coming back and understanding. This really is the way God has made it. It's what he means. Suddenly there's real beauty here, because now we can really begin not only to know something of God, but we can know something of each other or that person before me, whether I sleep with my wife or whether it's the person I meet in the tram, whether it's the Christian I meet here. I have a different way to begin. Oh, on different levels, but I don't have to deal only with that awful, awful surface skin if that's all there is. I'm not dealing any longer only with a language machine. It is the loss of these things that has deprived this poor generation of any real human communication. It's not drugs. It's not these other things. It's epistemological loss. Understand what the loss is. Men and women sleep together over and over again, but they're alienated, and they know it. They're alienated because they have no universal that binds the inward particulars and the outward particulars. But to the Christian, there is both. There is something that binds the two. Both the inward and the outward are going to be under the judgment of God upon the basis of the norms that He has given. And as I grow spiritually and bring the inward particulars into the thought world, meaning, values, and knowledge, mind you, you must bring knowledge in here as well, and morals, under the norm of God, to that extent, gradually, what I seem to be outwardly increasingly conforms to what I am inwardly. And then we can increasingly know each other. Isn't that beautiful? Third point. Shorter one. But maybe the most important of all, in the place where some of you are going to have to do some more thinking. The first point, me looking out. Point two, other people looking at me. Point three, reality and imagination or fantasy. Maybe this is the most important thing of the lot in a sense. Reality and imagination or fantasy. In one way, it's not nearly as important. Another way, it's tremendously important. Now, we've been thinking of having true knowledge of somebody else. But I must understand I have the same problem for me as a person. I live in a thought world which is filled with creative imaginations because I am made in the image of God. There's only one way we have creativity, one reason. And I just urge them to... This book of Edith is coming out in Hidden Art. It's really a great book because she deals with the creativity of that God has made us with and what it should mean as a Christian. But I must understand I live in a thought world which is filled with creative imaginations. It isn't wrong. I'm made this way because I'm made in the image of God. That's the reason I have this creative imaginations in my thought world. Being made in the image of God, I can go out in my imagination beyond the stars. Isn't that overwhelming? Because I am made in my imagination, I can go out in my thinking completely beyond the stars. Going out in our imagination, we can change something. It isn't just we can go out beyond the stars, but going out in our imagination, we can change something of the form of the universe as a result of our thought work. You ever think of that? Isn't that tremendous? I can change something of the form of the external world as a result of my thought world. In our painting, in our poetry, just as much, however, as an engineer or a gardener or a doctor, it doesn't matter. I change something in the form of the external world from my thought world. It's not just a matter of photography like Antonioni. Click, 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 and that's gone. I'm here. Here I am, and I'm able to impose the results of my imagination on the external world. But being a Christian and knowing God has made the external world, there is no confusion between that which is imaginary and that which is real. And I want to tell you that's something modern man doesn't have, not one little bit of it. So inwardly, we're not confused. There is a base to give us a reason for saying this is imagination. Isn't it marvelous to be a painter? Isn't it marvelous to be a painter? But don't you understand, for many modern people, being able to have fantasy is one of the deepest hells you can imagine, because as they begin to think, they can't tell what's the difference between reality and fantasy. And I'm not talking for a moment about the trip. It makes it worse.
Add the drug bit to this, and you can understand why you face that awful look in the eyes of so many of the present generation. But as a Christian, it's wonderful. It's no longer awful to have fantasy. It's marvelous, because as a painter, I can make things a little different from nature, and I'm free. Rembrandt did not paint photographically. Don't kid yourself. He does not just photographing nature. You make things a little different. You can make them different and never be afraid. You can understand that you don't need to be afraid, not one little bit. You can make a difference without being afraid, because I can understand that this is true. I have an epistemology that enables me not to get confused between the distinctions of what I think and that which is real. Thus it is the Christian. It's the Christian who should be able to let his fantasy and imagination, now listen with care, and even his daydreams. It is a Christian who should be able to allow his imagination and his creation, his fantasy, and even his daydreams to soar without ever being threatened. It's a Christian who can fly. Why are we flying? What's been the wrong with us all these years? Who's flying? Find him for me in the evangelical world. We have crushed it instead of helping it. But it's the Christian who dare take his imagination and set it totally free, because we have a reason for knowing the difference between reality and fantasy. Laugh, cry, say hallelujah, but do something, don't you? No, it's true. Don't laugh. It's horrible just to sit. Evangelicalism must learn. It must learn not to sell Bible-believing Christianity short. That's what we need to learn. In conclusion, then, it's not going to be perfect knowledge of this world. Nothing is perfect in this world. First and quite properly, I'm finite. And so there's limitations, proper limitations. And then horribly, we live in this fallen world. But nevertheless, there's real reality in these areas of which we've been talking. I do not have to wait for a person I love to exhaust some sentence or some phrase before we begin to have human communication. I don't have to wait for somebody else there to speak. I don't have to do all the speaking. It isn't my speaking or silence in the universe. He's there, and he's spoken. Here is the true answer to Wittgenstein and Heidegger's grappling with language. The fact that there is language, verbal communication, validates the real existence of the speaker. That's true. It does this much, not like Heidegger says, because there is a being, the small being that verbalizes. Therefore, we can have sort of a blind hope that being, capital B, has meaning, the very opposite. But the fact that the verbalizer does verbalize, that he is more than man, modern man thinks he is. And God says, yes, he certainly is. He's made in my image the infinite personal God who exists, and he speaks. See this in the horrible, hellish alienation about which modern man screams in his poetry and his art. Simply is no longer there. It's gone. It won't be perfect because we live in a fallen world, but the awful modern part of it is gone. So we see here three interrelated applications of the Christian view of epistemology. Not separate, but interwoven. First, as I look out to the external world, to the world of human relations, and as I want to know and understand another person, and then to the internal world of my thoughts, fantasy, and imagination, the modern alienation in the area of epistemology can make each of these areas into an awful, awful black hole from which there is no escape. Think of Kafka. Think of the bug. Think of the bug. Do you remember the bug in Kafka? Do you remember? Did any of you crawled with that? Kafka crawled. Oh, it's gone, isn't it? It's gone with us then. The same year there is a unity under the apex of the infinite personal triune God that gives meaning, reality, and beauty
to each of these three things of which we've talked. From a Christian viewpoint, because man revolted against God and tried to stay in autonomous, the great alienation is in the area of man's separation from God. When that happens, then everything else goes. This autonomous error is carried over into the very basic area of epistemology and knowing. And then man is not only divided from other men in the area of knowing, he's divided from himself. We have this tension between the internal fantasy, between the man and his internal fantasy, and the reality in the external world. If there are no common categories between the internal fantasy and the external world, man is divided and feels alienated from himself. He has no universals to cover the particulars of his own life. He is one thing inside and another thing outside. And you begin to hear this awful scream. What comes over, like the wave that comes over our modern generation? Who am I? Who am I? Who am I? Where does this modern scream come from? Why do we hear it in 95% of all the kids who come to us? I don't know who I am. Is it just that we're psychologically orientated? It's this, but more, it's that man doesn't know who he is. He has no way to know in this setting, the modern man. His attempts at autonomy have robbed him of any certain reality. He has nothing to be sure of when his imagination soars beyond the stars. He's not sure if there's anything there. He has nothing certainly there to make a distinction between fantasy and reality. But I want to say we want to praise God, because on the basis of the Christian epistemology, not only there is no problem, but this confusion is totally ended. The alienation is healed. My last sentence. This is the heart of the problem of knowing of which we've talked these last two lectures. And it is not solved until our knowledge fits under the apex of the infinite personal triune God who is not silent. You need him to speak. But when it is, and only when it is, there is no longer a problem of epistemology at all. And now I wish we could just begin where I preached last Sunday morning. That's what we need. Last Sunday morning sermon, I didn't know which thing to put it on. And I urge you with all my heart to go back and listen to that tape again. The fact where we cry out in that sermon that we want the power to speak to our generation. We cry out in the midst of all this, that we might indeed do the Lord's work in the Lord's way, and that we might have tongues of fire, that we might have reformation, that we might have revival, that we might see these things in their proper place, that this conference might give you knowledge. And isn't it great to have the knowledge? Isn't it wonderful to have the proper doctrinal base? Have the proper doctrinal base. If without the proper doctrinal base, there are no answers. Let me just say that. There are no answers. But if it's only the proper doctrinal base, I warn you with all my heart, it's only one seedbed of pride. I warn you that there's much of evangelicalism that is so filled with pride and its rightness that it's only a stench. But let us remember, we can add to it the next circle of which I ended my sermon last Sunday morning, the second great circle of knowledge, of really having this intellectual knowledge with which we wrestle so much. But you must understand, if it's only knowledge and it only leads to knowledge as a thing in itself, it's only a bad sense of intellectualism, and it's just one more seedbed of pride. If I am trusting in these things without looking to God in my trust, I am left without a tongue of fire to speak into the 20th century. But when I come and I see the proper relationships and how these circles fit together, the proper doctrinal base, the wonder of the fact that it's more than just knowledge, and I am brought to the place wherein, as I came time after time in giving this message. This message I gave tonight is the hardest message I have to give, I want to say. I moved over and over again so I can hardly speak. I've wrestled for years, and I understand when we're done, this stands in the place of the word of awe and the time, place, the worship of God. Down here. But when I come and I understand something of the humble heart, of the love toward God, the devotional toward the God who is there, and I see how great it is that he is there, and how indeed true it is that he is there. It's not just words. He's there.
And as I see this, and I'm moved in a devotional feeling and motion and love and adoration and awe toward Him. When in some poor way in my daily life, we practice and I practice the reality of His being there, the God that we say is there.
And we see these things come together, these circles. The understanding that I hope this conference has given you, the Christianity, need not be defensive in the intellectual realm. But the understanding that the end of the thing is not God's words and not a good system, but it's the God who's spoken. And as we come to this place now, we're ready. We're ready to end where the sermon took us last Sunday morning, I trust. Put the three circles together. There's no dichotomy. There's nothing platonic there. He is there. He is there, thank God.
Have the right doctrinal position. Without the right doctrinal position, get enmeshed in any form of existential theology from Karl Barth on, and you're dead. You have no answers.
You're caught in your own dichotomy. But go on and understand the intellectual answers. But when you're all done, let us end this conference and let's go home tomorrow with an understanding. We're not talking about bare answers, and we're not talking about merely giving bare answers to intellectual questions, so there must be honest answers to honest questions. We're talking about something. Do you know He's there? And do I know He's there? And do I live on the basis that He is there? Listen, there's no problem in this awful generation in which we live, except God's people who say they know He's there, and say they know all these things we say we know in the evangelical world. There's no real problem, except that each one of us, and then corporately, here, there, the other place, not in our own strength, but upon the basis of the finished work of Jesus Christ as He died on the cross, and in the power of the Holy Spirit as we look to Him, not in some strange way, but the scripture way, as we do these things, that God's people would simply stand up and live on the basis of what they say they believe, we'd get our revolution tomorrow. And may this happen out across the evangelical world as we turn and leave this place tonight and stream out across almost every one of the 48 states.